This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace, a brilliant young man who left Newark for the Ivy League, by Jeff Hobbs. Read by George Newbern.
Part 1. Chapman Street. Chapter 1.
"Why is the air not on?"
Jackie Peace asked from the back of the car.
"It wears the engine," her mother, Frances, replied from the driver's seat. "You can't bear it for 4 blocks?"
"He just feels hot to me, real hot."
And then, when her mother chuckled,
"What's funny?"
"You're a brand new mama, and that's why you have no idea."
"Idea of what now?"
"Babies are strong. They can handle just about anything."
Robert Deshawn Peace, the baby in question, lay sleepy-eyed and pawing in Jackie's arms. He was a day and a half old, 8 pounds, 10 ounces. When he'd first been weighed, the number had sounded husky to her. Now, outside the hospital for the first time, he felt nearly weightless. The street outside the car was dark and empty on this swampy late June night in 1980. The last of the neighborhood children had been called inside to clear the way for the hustlers, who governed much of the greater Newark, New Jersey area, and particularly this township of Orange, during the wilderness of the nocturnal hours. As Frances had noted, St. Mary's Hospital was indeed less than half a mile from 181 Chapman Street, where the Peace family lived. They were parked outside their home within 2 minutes. Chapman Street was about 100 yards long, dead-ending on South Center Street to the west and Hickory to the east. These bookends actually protected the 100 block from most of the neighborhood's nightly commerce. Dealers found the short stretch claustrophobic, and they were slightly wary of Frances, who never hesitated to march outside at any hour and tell them to get the hell out of her sight. Jackie carried her son inside, past the rusty fence and weedy rectangle of lawn, up the 5 buckled stoop stairs, across the narrow porch, and through the open front door, where the ceiling fan made the air cooler. The street had been deserted, but the parlor and dining room were crowded with family. She had 8 siblings, enough that she couldn't keep track of who was living in the house at any given time. Still dizzy from labor and first feedings, she didn't bother to count how many were there tonight, as she reluctantly let the baby be passed around the living room, from her father, Horace, to her sisters, Camilla and Carol, to her brothers, Dante and Garcia. Then her son was crying, and Jackie took him back and carried him to the room on the second floor where they could be alone, which was all she really wanted right now.
"Swaddle that baby and he'll stop the crying," her mother called as she ascended the stairs. "I told you I'm not swaddling anything in this heat," Jackie called in response.
And to Carl, who was something like an adopted younger brother,
"If you see Skeet out tonight, tell him to get back here."
Skeet was Rob's father. She laid the boy naked in the center of the mattress with a towel spread beneath him, and she lay beside him at the edge of the single bed to let him feed. They fell asleep that way, with her hand pressed against his back, holding him against her. His cries woke her in the early morning, and she raised her head, hoping that Skeet would be there. He had left the hospital room abruptly a few hours after the birth, saying he had some things to take care of. But she and the baby remained the only warm bodies in the room. Aside from a few failed attempts to strike out on her own, Jackie Peace had lived on Chapman Street in Orange, New Jersey, since 1960, when she was 11. The house had first belonged to her uncle, and had been left in her father's name when that uncle died of lung cancer. Back then, the Peaces had been one of 2 black families on a block of middle-class European immigrants, mostly Italian, and their race hadn't bothered anyone.
In that climate, people didn't think much about race, at least not outwardly. They thought about work. They thought about family. They thought about property. Men woke early and rode buses and carpools to the factory jobs that were the lifeblood of the greater Newark economy. Women stayed home and raised children. Neighbors, in silent and efficient understanding, kept an eye on the homes on either side of theirs, most of which were turn-of-the-century clapboards with peaked roofs set atop fourth-floor attics. Attics packed with old photo albums and records and dishware, remnants of the passing down of property from generation to generation beginning in the early 1900s. The homes were narrow and close together, but inside they felt big enough, with high ceilings and wide portals between rooms and long backyards shaded by native willow oaks. Police made regular patrols and were known by name. Central Avenue, a thoroughfare one block south of and parallel to Chapman Street, connected downtown Newark to the pastoral townships farther west. A succession of Italian, Polish, and Jewish grocers, pharmacies, clothing stores, flower shops, funeral homes, and local banks. On the south side of Central Avenue, Orange Park stretched out in 10 green rolling acres, shaped like an arrow, its grounds bright with mothers gossiping and children playing. Though dense and urban, Orange could feel very much like a small town where all needs, social, domestic, financial, were proximate and easily sustained. Because factories were the central commerce of Greater Newark, and because the workers in those factories lived in places such as Orange, families like the Pieces could feel vital, as if the history of the city of Newark were moving through them. If Jackie looked east on Central Avenue, in the direction of downtown, she could see in the distance the first of those brick, boxy towers known as slums in the sky. The Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development had erected 16 of these projects in the 1950s to manage the influx of Southerners seeking industrial work, mostly poor and mostly black. These communities had been intentionally segregated by race, in accordance with the common wisdom of urban planners at the time. If people were going to be stacked in such an uncomfortable way, they'd likely be more comfortable stacked with others of their own kind. The towers also served to segregate the urban problems of drugs, violence, and extreme poverty. With such signals largely contained behind those sheer walls and barred windows, people like Jackie and her siblings could drive wide around them, windows up and doors locked. Jackie's father, Horace, worked at Linden Assembly, a General Motors plant three towns away. She didn't know what he did exactly, only that his work involved simple mechanical tasks that he performed over and over again, all day, every day. She'd always figured this repetition to be the source of his sternness, his absolute insistence on correct manners and etiquette. To him, life was lived successfully by getting the small things right every time. If he grew lazy on the job, he'd be fired and replaced by someone else who wouldn't, any one of the thousands of workers who could do what he did. Likewise, if Jackie or her siblings forgot to say, "May I please?" when asking for something, they'd be slapped, once, hard on the back of the head. Days were about doing your chores and schoolwork quietly, keeping questions to a minimum. Nights were about staying out of Horace's way, also quietly, which was harder to do as younger siblings. Jackie was the third of nine, kept being born every 2 to 3 years. That house came to feel quite small indeed, once three people inhabited each bedroom. As the number of bodies increased, so too did the financial and physical strain, shared by all except the very youngest, of keeping everyone fed. Jackie knew from a young age that she didn't want a big family. As a girl in church and school lessons, she was taught that love was a boundless and ever-expanding entity. As she grew into her teens and found herself increasingly responsible for taking care of a generation of children she hadn't herself conceived, she learned that there were limitations, even to love. She understood those limitations definitively. Her mother out for milk, her father working a second job, her two older siblings gone with friends, and 15-year-old Jackie in the living room, tasked with keeping 6 stir-crazy little brothers and sisters from breaking anything, including their own bones. She didn't have enough love in her to avoid losing her mind at certain points. And in the back of that mind lay the knowledge that once she'd seen all those children grown and positioned out there in the world, the time would come not long thereafter when she'd be responsible for her parents in their place. She wanted a family of two children, that was all. Two children who would be hers, plus a man capable of fathering and providing for them adequately. Jackie hadn't been told that Carl's friend Skeet might show up, but there he was, not tall but barrel-chested and dark-eyed with a particular coil-like hunch in his posture, the kind of man whose presence was noted by all patrons when he walked into a bar, all except Jackie, even as Skeet approached her directly. She was well accustomed to eluding these sorts, men who relished playing the heavy. The year was 1979, and Jackie was 30 years old. She'd lost her job at a soul food restaurant on South Orange Avenue, which meant that she'd moved back into her parents' house from the East Orange apartment she'd been sharing with two high school girlfriends. Carl, a friend of the family, who had more or less grown up at 181 Chapman Street, felt sorry for her, as she had neither a man nor a baby and was no doubt hearing about it from her mother all the time. Still, Jackie hadn't been leaving the house much lately. Carl considered that a shame, because she was a striking woman, with small but intense eyes, a tall brow, an angular chin, thin lips and short hair. She refused to spend money on a weave that cumulatively projected an immovable conviction. Carl, when they hung out, got a kick out of the way men would approach her over younger, more classically attractive, easier women. These men seemed drawn to the challenge that Jackie's countenance most surely offered. Jackie was fun, too, and he'd convinced her to meet him at Passion's Sports Bar and Cafe in the Grove Terrace section of Vailsburg, just west of downtown Newark, a conveniently located stopover for the mostly black workers commuting home at the end of the factory shifts. For many, these stopovers could very easily become all-nighters, and the room grew rowdy around 9 or 10 o'clock, which was when Jackie and Carl found themselves at the bar, talking about work, money, friends, and how to get her out of the house on Chapman Street. Carl had met Robert Skeet Douglas a few months earlier on a factory demolition job, both grunt laborers who manually cleared the debris too fine for the diggers. They'd gotten along well. Carl was quiet and reserved, while Skeet was a witty leader of men. Their acquaintance had led to a loose partnership, hustling cocaine. Making movements, Skeet called what they did. Nothing major or particularly dangerous in the great scheme. At the bar, Skeet eyed Jackie and smiled disarmingly. She ignored him. There were plenty of girls at the bar who would be susceptible to his clearly well-honed charm, girls who didn't know any better. She said she had to get home to make sure her youngest brother had finished his schoolwork. "What's the assignment?" Skeet asked. Jackie replied that it was a biography of Frederick Douglass. Skeet proceeded to lay out, from memory, all the key moments and dates of Frederick Douglass's life. The smooth talk vanished as he explained humbly that he'd always had a knack for remembering things. Jackie let him give her a ride home. He happened to live on Pearson Street, just 2 blocks north of Chapman. She listened to more biographies on the way. Anyone she could name, he knew his or her story. Of his own story, however, she didn't learn much that night, or any of the nights that followed. "You spoil that child." Jackie heard these words from everyone. She heard them during her 4-week maternity leave from St. Mary's Hospital. In addition to having given birth there, she worked in the basement kitchen, and she heard them after she went back to work. She heard them from her parents, from her siblings, from her friends, and most often from Skeet. "You never put him down. Whenever he wants something, you give it to him. He sleeps in the bed with you," Skeet would say, not angry but incredulous, in a way that only Skeet could get. "Now I see why you won't marry me, because you're married to a 6-month-old. There's nothing bad about him feeling safe. And there's something real bad about him getting everything he wants when he wants it. A boy's never had to struggle for anything in his life. If I have my say, he never will." She talked back to Skeet, and that was one of the reasons he liked her. She didn't know as many facts as he did, and so didn't have the capacity to rebut arguments as he took such pleasure in doing.
but she could often shut him up with just a few words, Jackie's basic confidence in her own sense trumping all of Skeet's verbal tricks and back doors. She never let him talk her in circles like he did with Carl. She never let him be right when he was wrong. The stance that most flummoxed the man was her refusal to marry him because of the precise and intractable way she'd thought it through. Her older sister Camilla had gotten pregnant at 19, married the father, and had the baby. 2 years later, the father was gone, but the baby remained. Her best friend Janice had done the same thing, as had so many others. Jackie believed it wasn't the baby that drove a man to abandonment. She'd observed the bond between a father and his child, and knew it to be a true and powerful force. In her estimation, the union of marriage was what ultimately severed the union of family, the arguments over housing and money and time, the riving by unfettered friends, the inexorable waning of years and freedom. Men were aggressive creatures by nature, she believed, and as strongly and skillfully as they could push for immediate satisfactions, such as lovemaking, they could just as strongly, though less skillfully, push past any obstacles they saw as being in the way of those immediacies. The baby had not been accidental. She was 31 and he was 34. She was strong and he was smart. Each enjoyed the other more than anyone else in their orbit. They challenged one another in a positive way. They both had incomes. They were ready. But she'd been clear from the start that she wasn't going to marry him. Knowing that he trafficked in drugs, and intentionally not knowing to what extent, where or with whom besides Carl, she refused even to move into his home on Pearson Street, which, like Jackie's home, had been in his family for decades. But she still, 2 years and one child later, couldn't make him see that her decision was for his own good. He could live his life, and all he had to do was help provide, spare what time he could, and treat them well when he was around. She wanted him to expend whatever doting instinct he possessed on the baby, not on her. Of course, this orchestration wasn't entirely selfless. She had her own freedom to consider, too. Before Rob was born, she thought this would mean going out and meeting new people on her own terms, without the curfew of a possessive husband or the baggage of having been abandoned by one. However, the moment she first held her son, that fantasy evaporated, and a freedom of a different kind coalesced in its place. The freedom to raise her child the way she, and only she, desired. Jackie hadn't been out socially since the birth, and she had no inclination to do so. People looked down on her with pity, and even with scorn for this fundamental, atypical decision. She could bear their opinions, some of which were silent, some not. She had a baby boy, and she never saw a trace of pity or scorn in his eyes. Newark and the Oranges were not the places Jackie had known as a child. During the 1970s, her 20s, she'd been vaguely aware of the things people talked about when they talked about Newark. There were the riots of July 1967, incited by the alleged brutality inflicted on a black cab driver by white policemen. 5 days of burning, looting, sniper fire, and rage, at the end of which 26 people were dead. More than 700 were injured, 1,500 were arrested, and the texture of the city was forever changed. On one of those nights, Jackie and her girlfriends had ventured toward the city. They'd wanted to see for themselves what was going on, like a party they would regret missing. They'd been turned away by National Guardsmen at a checkpoint. There was also much talk about how the communities were no longer defined by the factories where people worked or the countries from which their grandparents had come seeking that work. Instead, they were increasingly defined by skin color, black, brown, or white. But very little of this talk had happened at her own dinner table, where Horace had presided from the contained space his soul inhabited. She'd seen teenagers throwing stones at squad cars, and then fence-hopping through the backyards of Chapman Street. She'd seen white-black fistfights break out in broad daylight on busy streets, and she'd stepped over the gore of teeth and bloody gum tissue left on the sidewalk in their wake. The men her girlfriends dated were too often angry and muttering about oppression. One of the reasons she took to Skeet later in life was that he never went to that place. He believed with a firm positivity that he didn't need to waste time resenting real or imagined social constructs, because he would always be ahead of them. The individual, not the people, was responsible for success or failure. Skeet aimed to succeed. After the riots came the phenomenon of white flight, which wasn't discussed, not yet, but was observed when she rode the bus to her first job after high school, working in the mailroom of Orange City Hall, for sale signs, 3 and 4 to a block. In 1973, the western spur of the I-280 was completed, a freeway that channeled beneath the Oranges, just 4 blocks north of Chapman Street, connecting downtown Newark to suburban enclaves in Morris County and the Watchung Mountains. Transits that had previously taken more than an hour on surface thoroughfares like Central Avenue now took 15 minutes. In the wake of the racial tensions that had erupted with the riots 6 years earlier, and that hadn't ebbed much since, this highway provided a corridor by which people who felt threatened or simply uncomfortable near the city's impoverished alignments could coast through them at 60 miles per hour. One thing her father did talk about, contemptuously, was the crooked real estate market, specifically realtors who profited off the civic unrest by convincing white homeowners that once one black family moved onto the block, more would follow, and their home's value would only decline if they remained. Jackie did, in fact, notice, more as a feeling than an empirical observation, that neighborhoods like Vailsburg, Irvington, and East Orange were becoming blacker, house by house, block by block, moving west from downtown Newark over the span of decades. In 1960, when Jackie's family had moved from Elizabeth, the population of East Orange was 39% black and 53% white. In 1980, when Rob was born, the population was 89% black and 4% white, and the area was known colloquially as Illtown. But as a young woman existing in the day-to-day, Jackie didn't concern herself too much with demographic shifts. She was simply happy to have a job when she could find it, to help pay for fun when she could have it. Her father, too, was happy to have a job still, because the city's factories were concurrently shutting down in great swaths. All across America, but particularly in port cities like Newark, St. Louis, and Chicago, improved transportation capacities caused manufacturing companies to gravitate toward cost-efficient real estate far from urban centers. Japan and China became major exporters of cheaper goods. American companies outsourced jobs to foreign labor. The service economy of the United States grew steadily while the industrial economy tapered and then, beginning in the late 60s, steeply declined. For these reasons, and many others, the factories closed, one by one, and the closures came with massive layoffs. Tanneries, glass, plastics, industrial machine parts, over 600 factories in and around the city, which had made the port of Newark the busiest in the nation for decades, shut down between 1970 and 1980. With public housing already at capacity and unemployment rising steadily, the dangerous side of urban culture began to spill down and outward from the project towers into the spaces left vacant by the fleeing working class. Across the wards in the north and west of Newark, and then still farther into East Orange and ultimately past it. The Peace Home lay just over the boundary separating Orange from the traditionally more dangerous East Orange. A half mile west sprawled the affluent neighborhoods like Tuxedo Park and the Seton Hall campus that still made Orange, on paper, a far more diverse and desirable place to live. Because of the technical remove of her address, because Orange was not generally associated with the slums to the east, Jackie couldn't have imagined while growing up that the ethnic grocers on Central Avenue might one day be replaced by liquor stores and check cashing centers, or that any of the houses on Chapman Street would be abandoned and boarded up, or that the crack of proximate gunfire could interrupt their dinner table talk. But the blight did come, inexorably overtaking Chapman Street, South Essex Avenue, and Lincoln Avenue before the suburbs west of Scotland Road formed the retaining wall that town lines drawn up in City Hall could not. This tide progressed slowly throughout the 1970s, and by the time it was complete, its effects had been sewn into the neighborhood's fabric almost as a given. At any rate, Jackie's physical life had always been based primarily in East Orange, where her friends lived, where she worked and shopped and felt comfortable, and where Skeet Douglas conducted his business. So, too, was Rob's. During Rob's early childhood, East Orange represented the second-highest concentration of African Americans living below the poverty line in America, behind East St. Louis. The violent crime rate of 3,500 per 100,000 people was almost 6 times the national average of 600, and 8 times that of adjacent South Orange, which stood at 400. The figure meant that any given person in East Orange had roughly a 1 in 30 chance of being violently robbed, assaulted, raped, or killed in any given year. An equivalent person in South Orange, half a mile away, had less than a 1 in 200 chance of experiencing the same. Horace held his job, though, and the family remained in the house, as they always had, keeping it open to anyone in the family who needed shelter. Around this time, a resident of the North Ward coined what would become New York's informal nickname, Brick City. Depending on whom you asked, the moniker referred to the hardness and resiliency of its people. The bricks that paved many of the older streets downtown were the easy availability of brick-shaped packages of crack cocaine. Skeet pleaded with her to stop working, move in with him, let him support her even if she wouldn't let him marry her. "I'm not moving to your house," she told him. "Why not?" "You know exactly." He looked at her as if she were the most cynical person on earth. "You think I'd ever put my son in danger, or my woman?" The kitchen job at St. Mary's was the first in which she earned an annual rather than an hourly wage. The wage still amounted to the national minimum of $3.10 an hour, a little more than $6,000 a year. The work itself was awful, mixing industrial quantities of low-grade animal products into stews ingestible by straw, portioning out endless lumps of jello onto paper plates from huge vats of it, boiling vegetables to paste. Yet, the pride lay in knowing that when she left work, work would still be there tomorrow, and that she'd receive a check on the 1st and 15th of each month. The hospital had a program through which, when the time was right, she could opt to attend night school for a management degree, qualifying her to supervise a kitchen. She'd worked in the cafeteria at Orange High School for credits, so a career in food service represented something like a linear trajectory, more than what many of her friends who ricocheted from job to job had. The money was important, but not as important as the ownership of her life apart from the other lives with which hers was entangled. Fundamental to that ownership was not becoming dependent on a man who dealt drugs, even if she loved that man. Jackie and Rob remained on Chapman Street. In that house, Rob read. Rather, Jackie read to him, but she felt as if he were reading along with her. With the opening of a book, a shift occurred in his eyes, and he nestled an inch deeper into her lap while angling his chin upward, and he seemed to age a year or two. Not a reader herself, Jackie went to the local library for the first time and pulled the popular titles, The Berenstain Bears, Richard Scarry Word Books, Dr. Seuss, Eric Carle. At a year, he began pointing his index finger at words as she spoke them. At 2, he was memorizing simple sentences after he'd heard them once. Always, he was entranced by the pictures, the successive turning of pages, the rhythm of his mother's voice. With her job, housing situation, and relationship status, Jackie could sometimes feel as if she had no right to have borne a child. But during those hours, she was meant to be a mother. Skeet, once he caught wind of the reading obsession, was righteously opposed. In his estimation, a toddler who spent all his time sitting in his mother's lap, immersed in fairy tales, wasn't getting any better prepared for life. A child, especially a boy, needed to be out and about, around real people, growing skin. "He can do all that when he's with you," Jackie replied. "Me, I'm reading to him." Skeet picked Rob up from daycare on the days he wasn't working. He tended to avoid spending time on Chapman Street, where he often clashed with Horace and Francis. Despite, or maybe because of his gregariousness, they were suspicious of him, and they also seemed to blame him for the no-marriage clause. Instead, he'd drive Rob around town to show off his son to various friends. These regular rounds were never drug-related. He knew better than that. Skeet simply loved people, talking with them, eating with them, helping them fix things. And it wasn't uncommon for him to eat 6 separate lunches over the course of an afternoon. He wanted to instill that sociability in his son. He believed that being curious about people was one of the few crucial life skills that could be fully nurtured in a place like East Orange. Jackie's hypothesis regarding fathers and sons had proved correct. The boy had a powerful connection with his father, and Skeet was generous with his time and money. But what she hadn't accounted for was the fact that, by the architecture of her design, the 3 of them were rarely together. Rob was at daycare, or with her and her family, or with Skeet. And so the mannerisms he picked up from each of them appeared abruptly, often abrasively, to the other. The toddler's mind had incredible suction, as his father's did. When he spontaneously recited "Go, Dog, Go" rhymes in Skeet's car, his father came back to Jackie, wondering loudly why his son's head was being saturated by stories involving canines picnicking in tree canopies. Dogs around here were often fierce creatures, bred for their aggressiveness, not to be treated so lightly. When Jackie put Rob to bed with a book and heard him instead singing himself to sleep with Grandmaster Flash and the Furious 5 lyrics, she winced. Skeet saw his 3-year-old son being bullied on the playground, timid around older people, quiet when other boys were loud. Jackie saw the same son pushing another child at daycare drop-off and grabbing his toy truck. Like any 2 parents, they fought. These fights happened mostly on the Chapman Street front porch at night, sitting in the plastic chairs that were chained to the wooden railing, Skeet's cigarette making loops of smoke as he waved his hands around. The neighborhood became desolate after dark, aside from a few clusters of young men passing periodically, smoking and murmuring. Some of them would offer nods of recognition to Skeet, a telepathy between men from which Jackie was glad to be excluded. Jackie's and Skeet's voices would echo off the cracked sidewalk. She didn't care if these street thugs or neighbors or her family could hear, so long as Rob, asleep upstairs in their room, could not. They concentrated on the particulars, the minute details of books and music and diction and schools. Deeper in their hearts, they were debating what kind of man they wanted their son to be. "The professor's right over there," the daycare lady pointed to a set of building blocks over which Rob, now 3 years old, crouched intently. "The professor," Jackie replied. "You didn't know we called him that?" Jackie thought she, or worse, her son, was being made fun of somehow, and began searching for a cutting rejoinder while mentally mapping out the second nearest daycare. "It's because he's so smart and he knows everything." Jackie looked up and saw that the woman was actually serious, that she called Rob Peace Professor in an earnest reference to his intellect. "Professor," she thought to herself, "my boy, the professor." Humbly, she figured that the moniker came simply because Rob talked so much. He could make her own brain go lumpy with the constant stream of comments and questions. More than any other child she'd ever cared for, he asked, "Why?" And maybe she was projecting this because he was her own, but she felt that he did so not out of reflex, but out of a genuine desire to understand the world and the people who inhabited it. On weekends, when it was warm, she'd take him to Orange Park by herself. A blanket, some canned pears and ham, a precious few lazy hours between the night shifts and backaches of the 6-day work week. For many years now, the park had been owned by the dealers, and more so as the progression of the 1980s brought crack to the neighborhood. Men and sometimes women, sometimes boys, sat on picnic tables in groups of 2, their feet planted on the benches beside malt liquor and brown bags. Their talk was generally cheerful, and they were unassuming enough until their patrons approached, and a certain gravity fell over the ensuing transaction. The executive of this enterprise was named Day-Day. He was a smooth-faced man in his mid-30s, Jackie's age, and he was always on his feet, traversing the diagonal footpaths. He never interacted with the dealers, but he was always watching. If you didn't know him, he looked like a guy strolling in the park for exercise and peace of mind. But everyone knew him. Jackie figured he must walk 15 miles a day within those few acres of city land. He knew Skeet and always paused by their blanket to comment on how Rob looked more like his father each day. On Sundays, he moved his salesman to the south side of the park and gifted the north side where the playground was to parents and children. The playground equipment was splintered, held together loosely by rusty protruding nails. Bits of glass from crack pipes and vials were embedded in the dirt beneath the swing set. The park was a highly secure place for people to do drugs after dark, more secure even than homes and apartments. The police didn't make regular patrols because they were too busy answering 911 calls. Policemen were more likely to enter a user's building during the night, answering a domestic abuse call from down the hallway, than they were to make a pass through the Orange Park playground. Jackie and Rob would eat their snacks on the blanket, never on park benches, because stupefied addicts peed themselves on them, and she'd followed him closely over the jungle gym while her eyes searched always for nails or glass or older, rougher children who had no business on a toddler playground, anything that posed a threat to her boy. Jackie entered the house to raised voices, one of them her four-year-old son's. She walked into the kitchen where Rob and her younger sister, Debbie, stood on opposite sides of a pool of milk and an empty upturned carton. He'd spilled it. Debbie was demanding that he clean it up, and once Jackie appeared, that she go buy more. Rob's arms were crossed, his eyes wild. His logic for refusal was that someone had carelessly left the carton open, and with the bottom hanging a third of the way over the shelf edge. That person should clean it up and buy more. That person was clearly Debbie, judging by her defensiveness. Jackie told her son, not gently, to clean the mess, and he did, huffing and muttering to himself with the fury of the wronged. "It's just not right," Debbie said, "that in a house with this many people, you fixed it so you're the only one he listens to." Too many people were spread across too many years in the house on Chapman Street, and the result was friction. Jackie and most of her siblings were blunt and to the point, like their father. The house could be a chorus of minor discontentments and accusations that became further compacted when Horace took on tenants on the third floor. Because the neighborhood was increasingly unsafe, everyone stayed in the house most of the time, pent up with no energy outlets, but to go at one another. Solitude, silence, stillness. These commodities were nearly impossible to find. Jackie wanted to move, particularly once Rob grew old enough to engage in arguments himself, something he did with particular tenacity. She experienced a spiritual erosion when watching her four-year-old scrap his way indignantly through an argument with an equally indignant adult, and do so with increasing tactical skill. The aggravated environment was no place to nurture qualities like reason and sensitivity. She had the money to move, barely, but nowhere comfortable and nowhere permanent. Renting an apartment in East Orange, the only neighborhood she could afford, was a massive and insecure endeavor. First came the actual search, which meant riding unfamiliar bus lines, through neighborhoods that changed from livable to dangerous to mortally dangerous quickly, and with no defined boundaries between. A street sign, a dogwood tree, an unthreatening house front, containing a drug den within. Then came the taut negotiations with landlords, who were always ultra-skeptical because they'd been had so many times before, the rules and restrictions, and deposit she'd never see again regardless. Then came the maintenance issues, the expenses of furniture and fixes, the fighting neighbors, the cronies of prior tenants knocking on the door in the middle of the night. And above all, the constant wondering, the fear of her job going away. Jackie had been through it all a few times before, and each attempt had ended with her back home. And now Rob is about to turn 5. She was thinking about elementary school, determined to send her son to a private school. That cost money. Not much, but not much was relative. She knew that the security required to afford tuition would be a stretch to maintain anywhere else except on Chapman Street. Skeet tried to make the extraction easier for her by renting an apartment on Chestnut Street, a few blocks from the house on Pearson. His plan was to conduct his business from the apartment and leave the house free and safe for his family. Jackie remained reluctant. She knew that in the deeply layered world of drugs, the nexus of commerce was the person, not the place. Two, in the very possible event that Skeet was arrested, and sentenced to a few months or years in jail, she had no interest in being knotted to any property bearing his name. "Look at me," he told her. "I'm 38 years old. Nothing's ever happened to me, and nothing's ever going to. I'm cool." And Skeet was cool about his involvement with the drug trade, as far as she could see. Jackie didn't like to talk about or even reference obliquely the drugs that Skeet sold. She had never gravitated toward the dealers in high school or the years after, the way many women around her had, enticed by the gifts of coats and jewelry, the bravado and relentless charm, the respect these men commanded from their peers. However, Skeet wasn't like the other dealers. He never flaunted the money he made, which didn't seem like all that much, just enough to even out the math between work paying X and life costing Y. He drove a boxy Volvo that had constant problems. He had jobs during the day, nothing permanent, but there was always something. The man wasn't lazy. His friends were, for the most part, people from childhood, decent-seeming men who'd stayed around and paid attention to their mothers, if not always their children. He coached a youth basketball team. He was always casual, never anxious. Most important to him in terms of safety, he didn't try to run with or compete against the younger generation of hustlers, with their codes and protocols always evolving toward brutality. "I got too much respect for human life to mess with all them youngins," he assured her. "I stay the hell out of their way." Skeet was loud and sometimes arrogant about his own intelligence and prospects, but he was quiet and conservative about drugs. What made Jackie wary was the huge extent to which Rob's father was known. To her, it seemed as though everyone living in the 3 square miles of East Orange, all 50,000 people, knew Skeet Douglas. Wherever they went out, she heard the constant hoots and waves and incantations of, "You call me now." He told her that this was just the kind of person he was, friendly with a lot of friends. Jackie knew that friends and friendliness weren't always directly related. Skeet had a huge smile, a beautiful smile, and he bent the truth very well from behind it. She didn't have to make a final decision on his offer because the house on Pearson Street burned down. She never found out why. Skeet hadn't called her for a week, rare even for him. She needed to figure out the daycare pickup situation for the month to come, and so she went to the Pearson Street house after work, ready for a fight. The smell of combusted carbon still hung in the air a week after the fire. Skeet was sitting on the front step, hunched over, talking to an elderly acquaintance from the block. His expression, one she'd rarely seen on him before, resigned, tired, damned. The house was completely gutted, just an assortment of heavy beams scarred black and ashy objects that had once been furniture. He muttered something about faulty wiring, and she got out of his way. And the house on Pearson Street just stayed like that, a torched shell, while Skeet moved into his rented apartment on Chestnut Street but continued to pay the property taxes on the now useless plot of land. Oakdale Elementary School was on Lincoln Avenue, just a few blocks west. Red brick, two stories with a footprint in the shape of the Chevrolet logo. The local public school looked like a nice enough place to send a 6-year-old. When Jackie's younger siblings had gone there, it had been. When Rob began kindergarten, it was no longer. The school's decline wasn't immediately evident. The interiors were generally well-maintained, the curriculum in keeping with federal guidelines. The other kids more or less what they were, kids just barely past toddlerhood. Jackie would walk Rob there and watch him join the stream of children his age going inside with backpacks and lunches, usually turning at the door to wave. But she observed something less tangible in the expressions and movements of the teachers, the laissez-faire attitudes of fellow parents. Most of these children, Jackie felt, were being sent here to be watched for a few hours, not to be taught. She had gently floated the idea of private school past her parents, and they'd both shaken their heads. "He's 6," they told her. "He's not reading Shakespeare. He's not learning cutting-edge chemistry. Kindergarten was about being with people his age, and maybe picking up some simple letters and arithmetic. Paying significant money for an elementary education was silly, considering what she earned. They told her to spend her income on feeding, clothing, and sheltering him. Education was what they all paid taxes for. A whole lot of taxes in this state. Still, she talked to Skeet about it. Catholic schools, the cheapest of the private options, generally cost $200 a month. If they split it, then Jackie would be paying only a quarter of her own salary toward education. Manageable, if not ideal. Skeet looked at her and said she was being uppity. Though he was speaking off the cuff, the word carried weight. Where they lived, being known by this label meant that you thought you were better than everyone else around you, that you deserved more, and that, given the opportunity, you would leave this place behind without a second thought. There was shame in thinking like that. Jackie didn't understand what the term had to do with her wanting the best education they could afford for their son, but Skeet had deployed it at just the right moment to make her second guess. So Rob went to Oakdale, where by Skeet's reckoning he would learn how to stop being a mama's boy and become a man respected, listened to, and followed by other men. This was more important than humanities and sciences. The transition to school brought another transition. Skeet began buying Rob things, mostly clothes and music. Jackie resented these purchases heavily, especially coming from a man who refused to pay $100 a month for school, but she stayed quiet about it, which was hard for her to do. The rap group NWA was the worst, with songs like One Less Bitch and Fuck the Police that contained not even a nod toward grammatical consistency, let alone morality. Skeet worked out in a boxing gym on Halstead Street a few times a week, and a punching dummy soon appeared in the corner of the room she still shared with the boy. A bottom-heavy rubber bowling pin featured a cartoon white man with a handlebar mustache that righted itself regardless of the force with which it was knocked over. Like a salty manager, Skeet worked with the boy intensely. He taught Rob to swing his arms laterally from wide angles so that a fist to the temple could be followed by an elbow to the chin. "Elbows, elbows, elbows," he would chant. "No one ever sees them coming." It was okay, Jackie told herself, in spite of all the ragging she'd endured for spoiling the boy herself. It was okay because there was no denying or interfering with the degree to which the son worshipped the father, a kind of worship she hadn't anticipated. Skeet wasn't the type to understand an infant or toddler. He didn't possess the physical and emotional patience required by the very young. As such, the rhythm of Rob's first 4 years had been mother-heavy, with Skeet present to a degree slightly beyond what might be expected. But all of a sudden, to Skeet, the child became a human being who could process situations, who formed opinions about people, who had muscles growing beneath the skin of his chest and back and arms. He looked like his father, too, with the overhang of his brow, giving his eyes a hard, caged expression even at rest. Whenever his father was due to pick him up, Rob waited in the parlor just to the right of the front door. Jackie didn't let him peer out of the glass, which was always shrouded by 3 layers of curtains, to preclude even a sliver of visibility from the street. All the windows on Chapman Street were treated like this to prevent any canvassing by potential burglars. The crack addicts who squatted in the abandoned apartments on Chapman and Center would take anything. But the moment Skeet's Volvo choked around the corner and his footsteps shook the front porch, Rob stood, beamed, and his breaths grew short with anticipation. When his father appeared in the doorframe, Rob would run and drive his shoulders into the powerful man's thighs. Then Skeet would bend over and grab the boy's legs and somersault him upward until Rob was over his shoulders, arms around his neck, and the boy would piggyback on his father upstairs. Then they'd work the punching bag for a half hour, and Skeet would take him out around town. When Jackie got her son back in the evenings, always before nightfall, a steadfast rule, Rob would be talking about the 4 or 5 people they'd gone to visit. He gave little in the way of details, not because he couldn't remember, but because he seemed to relish these adventures, these characters, shared only with his father. The boy kept them close to the vest, the hours he spent with other men. One weekday morning in the spring of his first school year, Rob wouldn't get out of bed. He moaned about an aching stomach. He had no temperature, so Jackie was skeptical. But she was also tired and late for work, so she made sure Francis would be around to watch him. As Jackie opened the front door to leave, she heard him call. Reluctantly, she went upstairs. "What?" she asked. "You want soup?" "Your son's sick and you're going to work?" he asked, the question an accusation. "I don't get personal days." "Whatever," he mumbled,
and turned away from her. She stayed home. As the day progressed, he began writhing and crying, the hardness cultivated under his father's watch slowly crumbling beneath the physical pain. Though Frances told her she was making a fuss over a faker, and thus encouraging these manipulations, Jackie took him to the hospital in the late afternoon. After 3 hours in the ER waiting room, standard even though she was employed there, she finally harassed their way into an examination room. His appendix was swelling fast. Late that night, it was removed. The doctor said it could have ruptured at any moment, and Jackie might have saved her son's life that day by not doubting him. Jackie knew Skeet better than he knew himself. And so she knew that no matter how authentically he presented himself as the tough guy, acidly cutting down the concept of private school, instructing the boy on dirty lyrics and dirtier fistfight tricks, driving Rob around East Orange while giving coded shout-outs to the hustlers, Skeet valued intelligence above all, and the early manifestations of Rob's intellect, picture books notwithstanding, excited him truly. The image became regular and nourishing. Father and son crouched over second-grade homework assignments, splayed across the coffee table, going back and forth over simple sentence structure and arithmetic. The same intensity with which Skeet could battle her he brought to that coffee table 3 or 4 evenings a week. Skeet harped on particulars that Jackie, in her own childhood, had never even considered. Penmanship, consistency of format, and above all, the importance of memory. With an old wisdom in his attention to detail, Skeet would drill Rob heavily on vocabulary, definitions, states, and capitals, until the facts became embedded in the cerebral circuitry. She could not believe how patient and tireless they could be, the father and the son, both with the work and one another. She would pretend to be cleaning in an adjacent space, but really she'd watch Skeet as he watched Rob set his lips and point his eyes upward to ponder some elusive connection. And their son, sometimes prompted but usually not, would invariably make that connection. Skeet would grin and squeeze the back of the boy's neck in his hand, then look at the subsequent entry to make sure the handwriting was clean. These quiet, unassuming moments, embedded as they were within her harried days, gave her not only pride, but also a simple beauty she'd always sought but never known, made more powerful by the fact that she participated only as an observer. Something positive could happen without her wrangling it through sheer force of will, and it could be shared within the trinity of mother, father, and son. In the shaded rear compartments of her mind, Jackie had always expected the call to come in the middle of the night, when it would jar her awake from the pleasant seclusion of dreaming. When the call did come, on August 9, 1987, she was at work, just before the lunch surge on a Sunday. Frances told her anxiously that the police were looking for Skeet. They hadn't said why.
"What did you tell them?" Jackie asked.
"I said I don't know where he lives or anything about that man." Jackie asked her to pick up Rob from summer camp at Branch Brook Park, since Skeet now wouldn't be able to. She kept working, eyes and ears in a heightened state of alertness, as she waited for men in uniforms to arrive and pull her aside in front of her co-workers. She thought mainly of what excuse she could give to her boss. After that, she thought about money and time. One of the maintenance staff had a record for dealing. It was all she could do not to ask him about the particulars of a man's being arrested for selling drugs. How much was bail? How much was a lawyer? What was the average sentence? But the police never came, nor did they call. In this moment, more than any other that had come before, she was thankful for the domestic arrangement she'd wrought. Because she didn't share Skeet's name or address, she would be free to manage the consequences this event would have on her and her son's future. She went home that evening and assumed Skeet's role with homework. The summer camp assigned short exercises to keep the children busy. She was relieved that Rob, who had turned 7 2 months earlier, didn't ask her why. Jackie was less patient than Skeet when it came to addition and subtraction problems and subject-predicate structure. She did her best, though, and only when Rob fell asleep did she start calling around, starting with Carl.
"When they find him, how long's he going to be away for?" she asked.
"They found him already. He was at Irving's house.
How long? How long for dealing?
Carl paused. The silence of reply. Then he told her that Skeet hadn't been arrested for drugs. He'd been arrested for murder. Two, in fact. Both young women, neighbors of his in that apartment building on Chestnut Street. Chapter 2 5 days after Skeet's arrest, and 3 days after his arraignment hearing, Jackie went to Essex County Jail for the first time. She went alone. The jail was a two-story blue-and-white modular structure made of cinder blocks, surrounded by two concentric rectangles of 10-foot-high chain-link fences. Sandwiched between the Passaic River and the New Jersey Turnpike, the atmosphere smelled of toxic, unfamiliar elements due to the General Chemical Plant directly across Doremus Avenue, a towering cistern of polyaluminum hydroxychloride used in wastewater treatment. Passing through checkpoint after checkpoint, and asked at each what her relationship was to the prisoner, to which she replied succinctly, "He's my son's father," she felt herself racking up distance from the outside world. She knew only as much as Carl did, which was hardly anything. Her lone hope, aside from the whole situation turning out to be a wrong-place-wrong-time misunderstanding, was that it would be resolved quickly. She knew that this impulse was selfish. She was thinking about the adjustments she'd have to make to get on with her life. She still hadn't told Rob. That a week had passed without her son seeing his father was uncommon but not truly strange. The boy hadn't asked, but she knew he was attuned to the anxiety coursing through the house on Chapman Street. She knew the question was coming. A guard escorted her down a hallway past the reception room for prisoners held here on lesser offenses, who were allowed to sit in open air across a table from their friends and family. Jackie was led to a narrow room with concrete walls, tight cubicles, low stools, guards stationed on either side of the plexiglass partitions. Knowing that her son would ultimately come here to visit, she'd hoped the place would be less than completely grim. It wasn't. A buzzer sounded. The steel-reinforced door across from her opened, and Skeet entered wearing bright orange, with his wrists manacled together and palms facing toward her. She hadn't expected him to be smiling, but the fact that he wasn't jarred her nevertheless. Even during the worst of their arguments over the years, Skeet had been able to grin his way through any conflict. He seemed curiously energized, but the energy was an uncomfortable one, fidgety, pent, his eyes darting everywhere except into her own. They had 15 minutes. He asked her if she could find him a lawyer to handle the bail situation and get him out of here quickly. At the arraignment hearing, bail had been set at $500,000. That amount had to be lowered if he were to get out, plan his defense, talk to some people, and see his son. He didn't seem to comprehend yet that his charge could not be evaded through guile and charm. She wanted to tell him this, tell him that people, two young women, were dead, and he might very well be sentenced to pay for their lives with his own. Instead, she said she didn't know any lawyers and didn't have the money for one anyway. She spoke clearly and directly, leaving no room for Skeet-esque rebuttals. The maintenance man at Jackie's workplace had told her in the intervening days about lawyers and the hours they billed. This was a capital case. Good lawyers would be beyond unaffordable. Bad lawyers would be ill-equipped for the task. And even the cheapest lawyer around would find a way to bill five figures, minimum. He told her that contacting the public defender's office might be the best option. Skeet could get lucky by being assigned one who truly became invested in the client. Not likely, but possible. She tried as hard as she could to look at him and not see a man who had killed others, to commit herself to the idea of innocent until proven guilty. "How's our boy?" Skeet asked. "He's good," she replied. Soon their allotted minutes were up. Too few for him, too many for her. The murder victims, sisters Charlene and Estella Moore, had been in their 20s. Charlene's infant son had been in the apartment, along with a third woman who had been shot in the face and arm but survived. Jackie's underlying hope was that this woman had witnessed the violence and would clear Skeet's name. She didn't know yet that the survivor, Georgiana Broadway, had identified Skeet as the murderer in the hours following the shootings.
Jackie couldn't help visualizing the scene. She had no context, and so, while lying wide awake in the middle of the night, she would make up scenarios that varied in detail but all shared the same expressions of disbelief or denial among the victims. The same pleas of don't or why,